In this Friday edition, we hear an ethnic media Zoom call regarding pandemic focused on COVID-19's impact on U.S. seniors. This is the edited version of a 70-minute call.
We know that the number of hospitalized patients for COVID has been increasing in the following states: Texas, North and South Carolina, California, Oregon, Arkansas, Mississippi, Utah, and Arizona. In Arizona, the report is that already 76% of the ICU beds are occupied. All of this suggests that there is certainly, at least in some states, a rising problem with the pandemic and possibly with the capacity of the state to handle the increasing number. But 3 to 11% for those aged 65 to 84, and 10 to 27% for those older than 85. And as Sunita said, more than 80% of the deaths among adult patients occur in those age 65 or older. We also know, and I think some of our speakers will speak to this, that public health approaches like social distancing leads to isolation, which is more toxic for older adults who may need help with food, activity of daily living, as well as getting more elevated risk for mental health and cognitive problems associated with loneliness. I'll finish with nursing homes. It's been really the epicenter of the pandemic. Over 210,000 cases and 43,000 deaths have occurred in nursing homes or other long-term care facilities. As of May 28th, 26 states had at least 50% of their COVID deaths occurring in long-term care facilities. One study up until mid-May of over 9,000 nursing homes found that a third of the nursing homes had at least one COVID infection. And the factor associated with having a COVID infection were larger facility size, urban location, a greater percentage of African-American residents, and not being a part of a chain. A modeling paper just published this week showed that the widespread use of face masks can reduce a transmission rate, or the RE number, to below one, which is a critical criterion for slowing down the epidemic. I and others think that the combination of relaxing the stay-at-home rules, an inadequate number of people wearing masks, or respecting social distancing are probable causes of the rise in the number of infections. I was asked to speak a little bit on the pandemic as far as the older adults are concerned. I think we all know that older adults are at higher risk of infection and deaths because actually both older age and other chronic health problems, which are actually more prevalent as people get older, are independent risk factors. One study a couple of months ago showed that the case fatality rate in the United States was less than 1% for those younger than age 54, but 3 to 11% for those age 65 to 84, and 10 to 27% for those older than 85. And as Sunita said, more than 80% of the deaths among adult patients occur in those age 65 or older. We also know, and I think some of our speakers will speak to this, that public health approaches like social distancing leads to isolation, which is more toxic for older adults who may need help with food, activity of daily living, as well as getting more elevated risk for mental health and cognitive problems associated with loneliness. I'll finish by saying that despite having months of warnings and infections, one-fifth of nursing homes still report they have less than 1 week of personal protective equipment or PPE left. Part of this has been attributed to delays in the delivery of the PPEs promised by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and FEMA. I'll finish my presentation there. Thank you very much.
The doctor just talked about two things in the opening part of his presentation about important factors to consider. And can you talk a little bit more about why tracking the number of positives or the percentage of positives is such a key thing to track?
I mean, basically, the more tests you do, the more you would expect to have more positive tests because there are quite a few what we call asymptomatic patients out there, patients who would not even get to the healthcare system. So if you're just following the number of positive tests, the more tests you do, the higher that number is going to be. And it's not clear whether that's just picking up cases that you weren't picking up before. Whereas the percentage tells you the percentage of positive tests goes up. That means there are actually more people getting infected than before.
Can you hear me? Okay, Dr. Tang, I have questions that because right now the business already open. So, what do you see on like a second wave that we're gonna have more virus spread in the community?
Yeah, I think that either we're seeing a prolonged first wave or we're seeing the second wave as states and cities, counties are reopening. And I think it's really essential that we follow the ways that we know will prevent infection, and that includes at least, you know, 6 feet of distancing and wearing masks. I mean, right now, as far as individuals and business are concerned, that's what they have to do. I think the public health department needs to do a better job of more testing and more contact tracing, which is the other way of containing this. But as far as the rest of us, I'm really worried about the trend to not make mask wearing not mandatory, because we already seen that in general, a lot of people don't wear their mask when it's not mandatory. And I think I reported last time that men are much more likely than women not to wear their mask when it's not mandatory. So we are going to have a second wave if people don't follow those rules. You know, again, we don't really know how to slow the pandemic down except with face masks and social distancing. Right now, there are no vaccines. So it's entirely possible that if we don't do a good job, we'll get the same problem that we had, you know, 2 months ago with the pandemic. You know, one of my colleagues said, you know, the virus only cares about one thing, and that is to get into somebody and then get out to some other people. That's all the virus is doing. Nothing has changed. So we would expect that if we don't do the right ways to prevent it, it will continue to be infectious.
Psychologist and a professor of sociology and nursing at the University of California, San Francisco. Dr. Harrington will speak today about the impact of COVID-19 on the elderly population in nursing homes. Dr. Harrington?
I want to talk about nursing homes because you heard about the high death rates in nursing homes. Nursing home residents only represent 0.6% of the U.S. population, and yet they are about 40% of all the deaths in the United States. We have to think about the background about nursing homes to begin with. For the last 20 years, there have been serious quality of care problems in nursing homes, and about 70% of all nursing homes are for-profit, and they're trying to make money by cutting the staffing levels, by keeping the wages, benefits low, and not providing health insurance. We know that before the virus hit, 3/4 of all the nursing homes in the US had inadequate registered nurse staffing levels, and 63% had infection control violations. So then when the virus hit, definitely has spread like wildfire through nursing homes. We have a new study that has just been finished for California, looking at nursing homes that were more likely to get the COVID virus. We know that if they had low registered nurse staffing, they were twice as likely to get the virus. And if they had low quality of care and they were large in size, they were much more likely to get the virus. And once the virus is in the facility, it can spread rapidly because so many staff and so many residents, possibly as much as 50%, are asymptomatic. And so we've had very inadequate testing in nursing homes. The testing has primarily just been done when there was a big outbreak, when we in fact know, and we've known from the beginning, that we should have been testing all staff and all residents because of the number that are asymptomatic. So the state government and nationally finally have ordered testing for all residents. But it's taking a long time to roll out the testing. Also, there was problems with not reporting adequately, not requiring nursing homes to report the infection rates and the death rates. We also know that minorities, are more likely to be placed in nursing homes with the poorest quality of care, with the lowest staffing and the most efficiencies. And of course, many of the staff who work in nursing homes are from minority groups. And they are at very high risk because of the lack of testing and the lack of masks and gowns and PPEs. The nursing home workers, especially nursing assistants, receive very low pay, and they generally have no sick leave. So they're reluctant to stay home when they're sick. And they also usually don't have health insurance. And so because of the low pay, many of them are actually living under poverty rates and are eligible for food stamps. And so they commonly work more than one job. And so then that we know from the studies by the CDC has helped spread the virus from across different facilities. And especially because many of them don't know that they have the virus because they don't have symptoms. So this is a perfect storm for nursing home residents and staff to contact the virus, and it's continuing to spread because of the slow testing and the slow use of PPE. And the poor policies and the poor oversight by the government. So I think we do have an important opportunity to try to understand the problems of nursing homes and to make some policy corrections in the future that will prevent infections and help us address this current emergency crisis. So I'll stop there and take questions.
Dr. Harrington, Governor Cuomo in New York has made the long-term care facilities not liable for the COVID-19 deaths of their patients. And Governor Newsom is considering the same type of legislation that would hold harmless the nursing home facilities. What do you think of that type of legislation?
I'm very opposed to that. 20 states have already granted nursing homes immunity. And part of that is based on this narrative that is being put out by the nursing home industry, that they were just in the wrong place at the wrong time. They didn't have anything to do with this infection spreading. And yet we know that's not true. Many of the worst outbreaks have been in these worst homes, and there's definitely been negligence involved in many cases. And it's not only the shortage of the testing and mask, but I think negligence with the lack of staff and infection control. So I'm very opposed to granting immunity.
I don't understand what it means to be asymptomatic. It comes up in so many of our conversations about this. Does it mean you have COVID-19, but you're just not showing it? How could that be? How could you be sick with this illness but not have symptoms?
Yes, that's exactly what it means. It means you have the virus, but you're not showing any symptoms. And if you think of yourself sometimes when you've gotten a cold, you really didn't have a lot of symptoms, but maybe the first 2 days you were actually giving the cold virus to other people before you got sicker. But this is an unusual situation where this virus in half of the people doesn't have symptoms. And so they're giving it out, both residents and staff, to other people.
What advice would you give to people who have elderly parents in nursing homes?
If they can take the family members home, that would be the best thing they could do. But in many circumstances, they're unable to do that. Right now, we're very upset about the restrictions on the visitation policies for family members.
Right.
We are trying to organize to demand that the governors let family members go back into the nursing homes. Of course, they need to wear a mask and gowns and be careful. But we need to have them in there helping the residents and being able to communicate with them, because we know residents are grossly affected by the loneliness, the isolation, and the lack of staff. They're not getting good care. They're not being helped with eating and drinking. And some of them are dying of dehydration and other problems. So we need the residents, the family members, back into the facilities.
What is the difference between a nursing home and, for example, somebody who just has two or three people in their house? Are they all considered nursing homes, or is there a sort of, like, as in small business, some have 50 employees or less, some have more? How do we differentiate this?
Well, nursing homes are organizations that are able to receive payments, Medicare and Medicaid payments, from the government to take care of patients. But then we have assisted living and what we call residential care facilities and small board and care facilities. So what you're describing is like a small board and care facility. And those are probably much safer than these bigger homes because there are less exposure. The residential care and assisted living, it's licensed by the state, and they do not have to have any nurses, registered nurses or licensed practical nurses there. And so they are even less able to cope with an infection and to carry out infection control requirements. And yet the governors have not generally ordered testing in assisted living and residential care. They have not ordered reporting. These facilities have many patients that have died already and staff members that are sick, and they are being neglected by the officials.
We move on to Dr. Farida Sarabji, who is the Regents Professor and Interim Head of the Department of Neurosciences and Experimental Therapeutics at Texas A&M's School of Medicine. Dr. Sarabji will discuss the molecular impacts of the virus and pandemic-related isolation relating to depression in elderly adults. Dr. Sarabji.
I'm very pleased to be here. Just to give you a brief idea of where I'm coming from on this, I trained as a clinical psychologist. I am currently a neuroscientist, and my area of interest is women's health and stroke and the consequences, one of which is depression. I want to just give you a very overview of how this current pandemic affects depression. There are really two ways. One of them is the social isolation that we know is a risk factor for depression. And I think this is something that Dr. Harrington alluded to when she was talking about the elderly in nursing homes. And the second is depression that is actually caused by the virus. So in the first situation, it's not people who are actually infected, but it's individuals who, because of the virus, actually have to remain in social isolation. So the impact of social isolation can be a quite devastating in many ways. The idea that you're worried about what form the illness might take, and your concerns about infecting other people. The problem is particularly acute among the elderly, because sometimes they might be in nursing homes where this became particularly problematic. But because the elderly are among the highest risk group for contracting the virus, as well as the most severe effects, they were asked to specifically self-isolate. So this problem is very acute among this population. It is a very serious health concern because studies after studies have shown that social isolation increases your risk of cardiovascular disease, so heart attacks and strokes. It increases the symptoms of autoimmune diseases if these individuals have autoimmune diseases. And of course, it increases mental health issues, especially depression and anxiety. So with respect to social isolation due to this current pandemic, there's very little evidence. We simply don't have the kind of data on mental health outcomes that we do on things such as mortality and cardiovascular disease, for example. That data is still being collected and it's still emerging. So what some authors have done is they've tried to compare what happened in the previous pandemics. So for example, this would be the Middle Eastern virus as well as the previous SARS virus, which occurred in 2002. And what this showed is that individuals who went through these times had a much higher incidence of anxiety and depression. So there are some things that we are learning from other pandemics, not particularly from this one itself. That data is still emerging. But we do have sort of a perfect storm because of individuals who've had to isolate themselves. So what exactly does social isolation do? If you think about it, social isolation is you're not particularly affected by the virus at the time. You're simply not interacting with people. What does that do to your physiology and how is that linked to depression? So what does it do to you? It increases the levels of certain hormones like cortisol, which is a stress hormone. It weakens your immune system. People who are socially isolated tend to have a higher risk of infections, and part of it is because their immune system doesn't cope as well with the any kind of passing bug, as it were. And among the elderly, this is particularly a problem because they are already disadvantaged because they have a change in their basal inflammation, as it were. So social isolation can have very dramatic impacts. And then the actual virus itself. When you get the virus, the first thought was, well, this is SARS, right? This is severe acute respiratory disorder. What we're now noticing is that there are a whole array of mental health issues that are occurring, including depression, including cognitive changes, memory changes, and people essentially feeling overwhelmed. So this is a broad basket of mental health issues. I don't know if many of you all remember the reporting of Chris Cuomo when he himself had the virus. He spoke very eloquently about the demons coming out at night. And this was the depression that the virus brings. So how does a respiratory virus, one that affects your lungs, affect your brain and your mood? It's a very interesting connection. The route by which the virus enters your body is through your nose. And the nose is actually somewhat exposed to the brain. And so the virus can actually end up in the brain, especially in a particular portion called the olfactory system. And the olfactory system, which is basically how we smell things, is very, very strongly implicated with depression. So now you have a virus that can enter into the brain and affect an area that we know is implicated with depression. The other thing it does is that once you have the virus, you can have a full-blown inflammation. You have these proteins called cytokines that are going to try to actually help resolve the virus, but they do it in a sort of a slash and burn manner. They're going to start killing off cells. They're going to affect things besides just the virus-infected cells. As a result, people will experience depression because of the inflammation that occurs. You see this very often with other inflammation type diseases, such as stroke, such as other types of viral infections. So I'll stop over here. I just wanted to make two points. And one is depression without the virus because of social isolation, and depression with the virus because of how it affects the brain. Thank you.
Our first question comes from Henrietta Burroughs.
You mentioned that we think of it as a lung disease, but I think the latest scientific evidence coming out indicates that it's more than that. It affects every organ of the body, the circulatory system, And in young people, it causes strokes. So is it still considered a lung disease?
Very good question. It was painted as a lung disease because of the term SARS, which is severe acute respiratory, because of the virus which causes the disease. But you're absolutely right. One of the big symptoms of the disease is clotting, and it causes blood clots, which means that now any organ in which these clots occur will result in a different type of symptom. So you have individuals, as you mentioned, young people coming into ER with a stroke. They don't have any of the lung infection. They don't have the cough, they don't have the temperature, but they have a stroke, perfectly healthy individuals. The other symptom that became very popular a few weeks ago was these black toes. Again, that's part of the clotting response. So yes, the clotting itself can make this disease very hard to diagnose, because the symptoms will depend on which organ is being affected. Excellent point. I'm glad you brought that up.
Thank you. Our final question is from Sandy.
Okay, very quickly, when you talk about the effects of social isolation, how do we tell policymakers when they advise elder people to socially isolate that they're giving them a prescription to be sick and to be depressed?
You make a very good point. We are walking this very tight knife edge between trying to keep people healthy by not getting a virus, and at the same time creating a set of circumstances where they will exhibit other types of illnesses and possibly become susceptible to other opportunistic infections, if not COVID, something else. This is a truly troubling issue, and I think Dr. Harrington did a very good job of addressing it, and that is, have the elderly close by. Don't isolate them. Try to get them out of situations where they will not have adequate care and they will not see loved ones. Now, there are a few other things that individuals could do. If there's access to platforms like Zoom, for example, it's possible to see people and get some of your interaction that way, which is also helpful. The other things to pay attention to are diet and exercise. Because the social isolation gets everybody to the point where you get less disciplined about your life because you're not out there meeting people. And I've been reading somewhat hilarious reports from my colleagues about how showering is a thing of the past. But the reality is, we need to hang on to routine. We need to eat well. As Henrietta pointed out a minute ago, the disease affects many things, including the gut. So good nutrition, good hydration is going to be critical. I'm not answering your question directly about how to advise policymakers, except to say, while the policymakers figure out what to do, here's what we can do on our own.
We move on to Dr. Fernando Torres Gil. He is the Director of Policy Research on Aging at UCLA Luskin School of Public Affairs. He will speak about the elderly population who are not in nursing homes and factors that could lead to their increased vulnerability to COVID, particularly for those who live in multi-generational households. Dr. Torres Gil.
The policy implications of what is occurring. Firstly, I know I was asked to address the issues of social isolation for those not in an institutional or even a long-term care type setting, but I believe that's been addressed quite well. Let me kind of frame my comments by saying that this terrible pandemic has revealed just the tremendous disparities that have been in this society for not just months or years, but for many decades. And here we're talking about how this country in particular has allowed social, economic, and educational disparities to widen in society to a point now where we have created tremendous differences in who's at risk and who is not. Certainly, one variable that is increasingly being used to really bring out these disparities is zip codes. But we also have to add race and ethnicity as well as age. The first thing is to just reemphasize what public health experts have always referred to, the social determinants of health. It's no longer just whether or not you have access to health insurance or medical care, but it's really about the combined impact of poor housing, low income, low educational levels, racial and ethnic disparities. And I bring all that out not to continue to create a somber view of what this pandemic means for older adults, but to bring out some of the hopeful silver linings that the pandemic has really identified and made visible to the public at large, to elected officials, to federal, state, and local government bodies, that we now are in desperate situation where hopefully from the pandemic, we can begin to revisit our regulatory, legislative, and policy approaches to begin to change these things and to begin to address these tremendous disparities which have put older adults, but also different groups at risk.
I just want to raise two key areas in terms of policy and the policy side of what we're addressing. The first, we've seen a resurgence of what we refer to as ageism and ableism, discrimination based on age and disability in different parts of the country. And as a member of the governor's master plan on aging, we worked very closely with the Department of Public Health and Aging and the governor's office, because initially a few weeks, as the state prepared for a potential resurgence in medical care and ventilators, they tried to sort out who would get priority if there weren't sufficient medical services. And the initial proposals, to our great consternation, was to in fact ration these services based on a point system that would give preferential use for these scarce resources to younger folks, those who were assumed to have a longer life expectancy, and those without pre-existing medical conditions. That would have targeted directly those who are older, those who have various types of disabilities, and would have put them at the back of the line, so to speak, a clear example of ageism and ableism. The good news, after pushing back advocacy, working closely with the governor's office, they completely turned it around, and their new care standards for potential medical resurgence of this virus is to ensure that there is no discrimination based on age and disability. I mentioned that first, it's kind of good news. We're able to turn things around, but also because in this pandemic, as we talk about social isolation and social determinants of health, we have to be very cognizant that there is sadly discrimination based on age and disability, and we have to work against that. Our new front in terms of public policy is working closely with the state legislature, the state senate, and the governor's office. Given the economic impact of the pandemic, the governor and the state are having to face major cutbacks in all areas of social, public, health, and educational services. Right now, we're working with the governor because some of the initial proposals were dramatic reductions in the very programs that allow older persons to remain at home. Major cutbacks in in-home supportive services, adult day healthcare centers, Alzheimer's support services. And so now our current efforts with our Master Plan on Aging group, with our fellow advocates, is to educate, inform the state legislature, work with the governor's office to minimize the impact on the various home and community-based services, without which would force many older adults to go back into skilled nursing facilities, institutional care. And we now know why that is not the preferred outcome. I'm hoping that the silver lining in all this is that the state legislature, the taxpayers, the governors, and the nation will begin to understand that what we really need out of this pandemic is a federal and state commitment to a dramatic expansion in home and community-based long-term care, to ensure that we have the technology to minimize social isolation for those that have to minimize social interaction, and hopefully to educate younger populations that they too will be old someday. They too will face a variety of physical limitations and disabilities. So our hope is that there might be a national reawakening that age matters, that disability matters, and that we are all at risk of the implications of this terrible pandemic. Because if we survive this, it will come back again in some different form. So now, hopefully, the public and the nation as a whole will reinvest in public health, in long-term care, in home and community-based services, and certainly the terrible disparities that have impacted especially African-Americans, immigrants, and Latinos, intergenerational, inter-ethnic, and multi-generational issues, if there's time. But at least I wanted to bring out the policy implications. Thank you.
Thank you so much to all of our speakers. There are so many more questions, but we are well over time.
You have been listening to an Ethnic Media Services conference call regarding COVID-19's impact on U.S. seniors, a production of Ethnic Media Services, recorded and edited right here at KIDE Studios, Hoopa, California. Thank you for listening.